not always the saving of a life as much as it is sometimes just the saving of somebody's psyche. People feel like they're going to die in a place, and you're able to get there, establish an evacuation, to a secure place. And if they were involved in a rock slide, and their wife or husband has just died, and they just are completely distraught, and it's like just being there for somebody who has absolutely just experienced the worst thing they've ever had.
In this session of the World Extreme Medicine Podcast, I am speaking with paramedic Emil Sante about the evolution of his incredible career. He has enjoyed a true portfolio career, playing to his dynamic interests, and is always stepping up to fulfill the needs of his community in rural Colorado. In this podcast, we will discuss what it is like to be a remote medic, an extreme coroner, a leader, and a family man. All while skiing, snowboarding, mountain biking, climbing, flying, taking adventure motorcycle rides with his family, jumping into and out of helicopters with search dogs, and setting off explosives to intentionally trigger avalanches. If you have ever wanted to do any of these things, please stay with us. So my guest, Emil Sante, is the Lieutenant Paramedic for the Telluride Fire Protection District. He's amassed an incredibly diverse and dynamic career with 26 years in EMS, 25 years in ski patrol, 12 years as an extremely rural county coroner, and 5 years as a flight medic. He has always been willing to step up and serve the needs of his community in remote San Miguel County, Colorado. I asked him to be my guest on the World Extreme Medicine podcast today to discuss some of the more extreme situations in which he has found himself and to get him to share some of the survival and medical tips and tricks of the trade that he has learned along the way, and also to tell us how he got into these various endeavors. So Emil grew up in Louisiana and Telluride, Colorado. He went to the university at Missouri State, where he enjoyed climbing, mountain biking, and working in outdoor gear shops. He then traveled for a year through India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, and Tibet, where he actually met the Dalai Lama in India. He then moved back to Telluride, Colorado, where he started working in construction and volunteered initially with EMS and SAR. He has been with the Telluride Fire Protection District since 1995 and transitioned from volunteer to a paid leadership role. He began working as a ski patroller in 1997 and has been one of the supervisors since 2009. Additionally, he took on shifts as a flight medic from 2006 to 2011. He has worked with San Miguel County Search and Rescue since 1996 and is currently on their board of directors. Something that sets him aside from traditional extreme medics is that he also worked as a deputy coroner from 2000 to 2010 and has been the county coroner since 2011. And we will delve into more detail on what it is like to be an extreme remote coroner later in the podcast. Currently, he has maintained several roles and is a Telluride Ski Patrol supervisor on the Howitzer, aka Explosives team, and is their chief medic. He is the Lieutenant Paramedic for the Telluride Fire Protection District and is their chief medic as well. He is the county coroner and volunteers with the San Miguel County Search and Rescue team, especially when there's a particularly challenging call at hand. So his hobbies include spending time with his family, two biological and two adopted children, three dogs, and his beautiful wife, Pamela. They are a big part of his life on and off the mountain, and he loves riding mountain bikes, running, and rides some adventure motorcycle rides with family each year. He also, of course, enjoys skiing and snowboarding. So, Emil Sante, welcome to the Extreme Medicine Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
I'm so excited to
have you here. Can you hear me okay?
So, I'd like to address, yes, I can hear you. I would like to address this first. Do you think that you have ever qualified as a ski bum living out in Colorado? And I say this in jest because I know that you have thrown your heart and soul into every career role you've ever undertaken.
I think I qualified as a ski bum when I moved back to Telluride after being gone for many years, and I had decided simultaneously with my brother at the same time. He was coming out of Oregon and I was coming out of Arkansas. And we both just decided, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to figure something out in Telluride, and I'm going to make it work because that's where I wanted to be. And, you know, it, you don't realize this when you're growing up there, how good you have it. It always takes going away and seeing the rest of the world. And then you're like, why did I leave? You know, at any rate, I came back and kind of like you said, I did construction for a few years and some academy stuff for some a few years. But I was skiing and snowboarding a lot. And, the true definition of a ski bum is just somebody who just spends all their money on their skiing endeavor only. I wouldn't say I spent all my money doing that, but pretty close.
I hear that. So also, really, as a lighter note, are there still no stoplights in San Miguel County?
None that I've seen.
Nice. I loved that about that place. So when you were younger, like you have this incredibly diverse career now. When you were younger, what did you envision would be your career and lifestyle as you grew up? Like, was there, did you have particular expectations?
Yeah, you know, I think like anybody else, I drifted towards this, that, or the other at times. And I guess it wasn't until after college and some traveling that I kind of got my head figured out that I didn't want to go into business school and I didn't want to do some of the things that I was, you know, pursuing at the time. And being someplace that fed your soul was more important than feeding your wallet. And so I went back to Telluride and I just decided to learn skills that I thought would be beneficial to me for the rest of my life. And that sort of became my quest.
I've seen that in you and beneficial to the community too. You filled so many roles there, so many needs. So you took a year off to travel after the world, after university. And so what do you think is the value of gap years and traveling to remote places?
I think very important. If you're somebody who has questions about yourself or anything else, staying on a course that may not necessarily speak true to yourself, you know, is an empty motion. You know, it's without any soul. And if you're treading water, doing something you're not really sure you like, or that you're being pressured in by friends or family or anything like that, you're not doing yourself any favors.
I could not agree more. I love that. That was so well put. And so, you've had so many different roles and you continue to have so many different roles, because I would say you're someone, as you evolve and maybe you think about turning something over, they say, no, let's keep you and make it work. And you can do it all. So what, do you have a favorite of all of your projects or your roles that you, since you've lived there?
Not really a favorite. I've always called Ski Patrol my therapy job. And what I meant by that is, I was almost always enthusiastic to go to work. You know, I always love getting up and moving towards the mountain and going up the lift early in the morning, especially if it's snowing or especially if we have, Abby work to do, that sort of thing. But it's the kind of job that, for me anyways, I always wanted to keep it light and never, I mean, it has to be serious at times, but never, sure, never get involved in the politics too deeply. And a therapy job where you laugh your ass off all day long, you ski a lot, you ski good snow a lot, you blow shit up, and you come home exhausted, you know, and you know, you put in a good day, you know, whether you get paid a lot or not doesn't really matter, you know.
And absolutely. I love that. A job that feeds your soul and a therapy job. That's brilliant. Just brilliant. So how'd you end up doing Ski Patrol? Like, you're in Telluride, you're doing construction.
I was actually doing some snowboard instructing, and I was a new EMT, and I don't exactly remember what the spark was, but I went up and talked to Paul Sherry, was the director at the time, and I knew that they were having a lot of injuries in our newly formed terrain park, you know, And again, I was on a snowboard most of the time, and I was like, "Hey, I know you don't have any snowboarders on ski patrol, but I'm pretty sure I can bring those stats down. You just need to walk the walk and talk the talk." And he bought it for some reason. And the next thing I know, I'm in an OEC class, as well as their refresher, and I become the first Telluride ski patroller on a snowboard. And so I did that for 2 years before I went back to skis. And we can go into why snowboarding is not a good idea when it comes to the backcountry and skiing and all that. And you can find people to argue that all day long. But truly, it was fun to do for a while just to kind of prove that it could be done. But I don't really get on the mountain and snowboard anymore in uniform, you know. No, I haven't done that in a long time.
I would imagine it could be a little awkward trying to pull a sled and stuff like that. I know most recently I went skiing with my partner and he was on a snowboard and I was on skis and the snow was a little bit wet and heavy and I was having to like slingshot him to keep him going, whereas I could just kind of hop around and skate around.
If you know the mountain, you can kind of forecast where you're going, where your speed needs to be kept, things like that. So I was able to pull it off without too many complaints, you know.
Yeah, too cool. Very cool. Very cool. And so your training for the job of for ski patrol was EMT, and then everything else was like, okay, we're going to hire you, we're going to train you how we want to train you.
Correct.
Awesome. And a lifetime of snowboarding and skiing. Yes. Yep. So I lived in Telluride for many years, and I remember everyone gathering on Main Street, anxiously awaiting for the ski patrol to throw out bombs to release avalanches intentionally, you know, for safety. But it was still just really cool to see the video of the snow just coming down at the end of the valley. Do you get to throw out those bombs? And like, do you throw them by hand? Do you launch them from a cannon? Do you toss them out of a helicopter? Like, how does this happen? And how do you also, like, is how much math goes into like the trajectory and the placement of that?
The math involved in the howitzer is pretty much predetermined. Like we've set things up ahead of time, so there's very little calculating going on out on the snow. You know, we've tried to establish this ahead of time. When it comes to the avalancher, which is a nitrogen propelled rocket, basically, there is no math. You're just kind of like, you know, I'm like trying to figure it out, and it may go off a little bit, and then you just kind of move it a little bit. There's no math there. We shoot pipe bombs. We have they're called bomb boxes that throw out these 15-pound charges. Obviously, the hand routes are endless, all different types of explosives. And then there's the helicopter work. We do fly around and drop, we call them turkeys, 25-pound bags of ampho and cast blasters out of the helicopter. And there's no math in that either. It's just sort of like try and hit that spot down there.
Oh, that
It's
sounds like so much
definitely
fun.
it's the Wild West for sure.
Yes, it is. And I want to take a minute to tell all the young people who are wondering, can I make a living skiing and blowing stuff up? It's possible. It is
Yeah, more
possible.
so than ever before.
Yes. Oh, that's so cool. That's so cool. So the other story I remember about you is that there was a dog up for adoption whose owner was heartbroken that they couldn't keep it. You know, they were trying to get him a home, a bujuko. And full disclosure, I knew and loved that dog back when I lived in Telluride. And you adopted him and turned him into a ski patrol and SAR dog. And how was this process? Because he was not a puppy at the time.
No, I early on, you know, just hanging out with him, recognized how intelligent he was, and went to the lead dog handler. We keep six dogs on the mountain, or allow six dogs to be active during the course of any year. And I went to the lead handler and basically told a little bit of a white lie about his age, you know, that he was a puppy. He was under one. He was probably more like two or something at the time. But I worked with him all summer long in preparation for that winter. And so when he came on, he was full grown. Not only just full grown, but Bajuko was half yellow lab, half husky. So he was a good 75 pounds, maybe at his strongest, closer to 80. So picking up a dog that's 80 pounds, that 10 years that I ran Bajuco, hands down, my back was the strongest it's ever been, you know, skiing with a big boy like that. But, you know, like they say, you don't really run them down the steep terrain, and, you know, you kind of protect them from themselves because they just want to go. He did the job for 10 years, and he did it really well, and he went on quite a few rescues. We never had he never had to dig up a dead body, or definitely never had a live burial, but we went on many attempts, you know, and he's very good at the job. Very dedicated dog, and I still have him as a screensaver. He was a special dude.
He really was. He was such a special dog. I love it that he got to live that life. He got to be a hero. And I think that's great. So I know that weather can be frightful out in Colorado, and it can change on a dime. And depending on the snowpack, there can be intense avalanche dangers. I still get all the avalanche alerts, believe it or not, about the snowpack quality. So tell me about a time when you had to respond to help a different county because they had one of the largest avalanches in our history anyway.
Many times I've been on avalanche calls where it's out of county, you know, like in the San Miguel or the San Juan region, you know, the dividing lines are usually the crests and the peaks of the mountains. So avalanches don't care, you know. Telluride or San Miguel County is set up as really one of the better search and rescue and obvious ski patrol type counties. And so a lot of these types of incidents, they look to us to take care of things. And the one you're speaking about was in San Juan County, and it was just over Ophir Pass. And it was an enormous wet slide that caught four people. Three of them were kicked out with minor or no injuries, but it was the person that triggered it, the lead guy, who traveled a mile and a quarter down this valley before this thing came to a stop. It was one of the biggest slides I'd ever seen, and it had created its own luge as it went down. It looked very, very different than any other slide I'd ever seen before, just because it was a wet slide and had started to set up. We flew in, it was me, two other patrollers and two dogs, and Bajuco was one of them. And basically we're trying to do a search from miles, the top down. We don't miles. Miles, and wow. it's very steep, and it's just, imagine like one of those it was just rolling and extremely slick, and the dog's claws were out the whole time, and it was just an ice skating rink, and you couldn't really ski on it, and the dogs couldn't really stay on it, and it had pushed up so much snow, there were like 12, 15, 20 foot levees on either side where this massive snow would push down. I'd just never seen anything like it, you know. Obviously the male that traveled a mile and a quarter was dead. I believe it was an asphyxiation death that finally, you would think it would have been trauma after that much distance, but I think he was just like suspended in this enormous amount of snow, you know. But it was one of those calls that it was so profound you'll never forget it, you know.
Oh gosh, absolutely. I have a few of those too. So when I was doing search and rescue, I was always afraid it was going to be one of our friends that we were going to go search for, and of course you obviously you don't have to name names, but you know, do you have these same fears, and how many times have you had to dig one of your friends out of an avalanche?
One close friend. There's been two or three others that I knew who they were, or I knew their wives or girlfriends or something along those lines when you go and make notification after you've verified everything. But yeah, it's one of those things you even say on EMS calls, not so much on the Skiria, but definitely when you hear that it's a really bad call, you know, you kind of like, boy, I sure hope I don't know them, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, backcountry is a little different because it's almost always a local, you know, almost always, you know, I would say a local to Telluride, if not one of the surrounding hamlets, you know, Ridgeway or something.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're going to know them on some level, and it's just, I don't know. It just hurts differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever had a chance to like rescue one of your friends?
I know
in our field, it ends up being a lot of body recovery because of the time
and
the extremity of the situation and the terrain, but every once in a while you get a save.
We've had our calls that were not necessarily, I mean, you always think it's going to be trauma, you know, and then it turns out it's sometimes, a male that's been around in this community forever is having a heart attack in a really bad place, you know. And, you're riding in on motorcycles or hiking in or maybe by helicopter, you know, and it turns out you know who they are, at least. I wouldn't call them saves. Would they have died? Probably not, you know. That's happened a few times for sure.
Yeah. And what do you think about the avalanche backpacks? Like, have you seen a fatality when the avalanche backpack has been deployed?
Yeah, no, I've seen the airbags tear. I've seen Abby lungs tear open. I've seen, you know, the amount of energy displaced in a serious through the cliff band, through the trees type of avalanche. These are just tools to hopefully, keep you alive a little longer, you know, or keep you from going under or things like that. But again, it's just a tool. And if you are someone that feels like you've got these things and you're going out there and pushing it in extreme terrain and think you're safe, I guarantee you, you are not. And I was actually involved in the first deployment of an official avalanche in North America. It was on the Telluride ski area. And the guy I was skiing with, we were just starting to play with these things. I didn't even know he had one on that day. That's how naive I was. And he was behind me. We had gone from one side of the hole to another. And he came in right behind me. And this convex slope that we were on broke, and it broke like 3 feet behind me, but took him down. And he went for, I don't know, 1,000, you know, foot ride, and it kind of tapered out in the skirting. He was not injured, but it was the first time I'd ever seen the wings explode on an airbag. And we looked it up, and as far as we knew, besides testing and things like that, this was the first real deal in North America, you know. Yeah, well, I didn't either at the time.
It happened in Telluride. That's crazy. Yeah. So Telluride's also a place where, especially in the summer, like Gold Hill, there's a lot of paragliding, there's hang gliding.
I got a great story for that too.
Awesome. Yes. Are there ever any accidents or injuries or issues with paragliding or hang gliding?
Yeah, no, all the time. I've picked up many dead hang glider accidents, many dead paraglider accidents. One of my most memorable one turned out to be a friend of mine who no longer paraglides, but he broke his back in numerous places. It was, he was running off, he got airborne and then flipped upside down and came down probably about 100 feet and slammed. I was care flight that day, and we got called for a paragliding accident. We flew over, landed at the airport in Telluride. Because of the altitude density and the heat of the summer, we dumped the nurse and a whole bunch of gear, and I just went up with the pilot, and it was just a little bit more my forte. And we did a hot landing. We had people already up there that were packaging. Turned out to be a buddy of mine that I still do ski patrol with to this day. And yeah, he was messed up. He still has issues from that day, but overall, he's doing great. I mean, he's alive and still doing what he loves to do. So he's super lucky.
Oh, that, yeah. Thank God. You helped me when I first injured my back.
Yes.
I remember you were hurt.
Oh yeah.
Yes, I was hurt. That was awful. I've battled with this a little bit, and do you ever feel like this one almost gave me PTSD, or this one did give me PTSD? Like, are there any that you've struggled with? I know San Diego County does a really good job of debriefing, and I think that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I think debriefing and counseling and talking about it are all very important. As far as a call giving you PTSD, I think there's potential there for something if it was really close to you, close to home. But it's the perpetual exposure, which is the hardest thing to measure. That constant exposure to stressful situations or grotesque incidents, you know, images, things like that. Those are the things that that culmination of exposure that they warn you about the most. It's not one particular thing. It's just the constant barrage of it. I think it's very real. I know some people that have some real problems with it. I know we're not all wired the same, you know, and I honestly feel like I do have that when it comes to, if I find myself be feeling down or short with like my family or friends or something like that, I immediately turn the focus on myself and, well, why are you acting like this? Why did you just do that? You know, and make sure you're not self-medicating. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that can help you. You know, you talked a little bit about counseling and things like that. And there's even some stuff that is very alternative that I think are very effective that, you know, people should look into if you're having problems. But, you know, knock on wood, overall, I feel like I've been able to deal with this for what it's worth, maybe better than most. And I've not really had any serious issues where I've had to go see a psychiatrist on a regular basis or anything like that. So knock on wood, I feel fortunate without a doubt, you know.
I had one that hit me hard. It was a kid who died. And that one was really tough. And I did go talk to somebody for probably 8 months.
Yeah.
And just because you keep thinking somehow it's your fault. And then I finally realized that it's not, you know, that it yeah. wasn't, but sometimes it catches up with you a little bit.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think San Diego County, like that, you know, Bill Masters, Eric Berg, Jill Masters, I think they did a great job back in the day of setting a precedent of, you know, we will debrief, we will talk about our feelings. And I think that has set me up with skills for the rest of my career that I've been able to use to help myself and my team get through things.
Nice.
So I've been very proud of that. Yeah, absolutely. So how did you, was it, I mean, it seems like a natural evolution to transition from ski patrol to search and rescue, because there's so many coordinated exercises that it really is probably very helpful to have somebody uh-huh. who walks in both lanes. But how did you end up on the San Miguel County search and rescue team also?
That's a real good question. I don't remember exactly how I ended up there. If it was from friends or I can't remember exactly how I got involved, but I remember that I was very happy to be involved. And, one of the things that, I kind of made a mission of, especially I was pretty ambitious at the time, but those first younger years for me was being involved in EMS, SAR, as well as ski patrol, trying to be that conduit for communications. I remember there was some animosity between agencies back then, mm-hmm. and there might still be a little bit today, you know, but in having a foot in all of those games, you know, it obviously opens your eyes to, hey, we got, there's bigger things here going on besides that chip and ego on your shoulder there, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So let's all get in on the win here and, you know, get together and get this job done. That's the most Absolutely. Important thing. I always tried to bring, you know, and be that mediator between the agencies, make people understand that we're all the same here.
Yeah, we are. Everybody's on the same team. And I think that's brilliant. I think that was a brilliant endeavor on your part as a very young person, to see that void and to fill it. I think that was very, very honorable. So what do you, you know, you have paid roles, you have volunteer roles. What do you love or find challenging about being a volunteer? Because I know this team can get pretty busy.
Yeah. Well, search and rescue is one of those things you never know when a call is going to come. And sometimes it can come out at the most inconvenient times of the week and day or whatever. But luckily there are, it's not a constant like say EMS is or like ski patrol. There's always things going on. So I always kind of put those in a different category. And because of the frequency, I would always try and get involved in those just to make sure that things were being handled. And so for search and rescue, I don't really look at it, you know, as the same in as far as the three disciplines there.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like I guess responding almost to it like a disaster, and you know, you step it up and everybody does what they can do to help. And
yeah, it's not usually a frantic emergency either. You know, it takes time to kind of organize a SAR mission and get things going. Whereas ski patrol is like seconds, you're out the door. EMS is seconds, you're out the door, you know.
I still have a Placerville Fire Department shirt that says same day service.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they responded, yeah. You know, things were so far away that if you got there in an hour, it meant you were breaking the law.
That's true. Same days. I'll send you a pair of underwear. How's that?
Yes. I love swag. So now, was it with San Diego County? Was it with search and rescue? Did you deploy to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans?
Yeah, it was.
How did that work? Like, what did you guys do, and what was your? Did you just take a boat and go?
Yeah, it was kind of a rogue group. You know, we all just figured out a way to take some time off from our lives here, and everybody. I mean, if you remember, like the energy in the air when Katrina hit. Hell, the energy in the air when 9/11 hit. You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. It was like everybody saw. A bigger mission, a more important thing than themselves to get involved in. And what was amazing about it was, yeah, there was a physician, a few paramedics, a couple of EMTs, and we basically just loaded some provisions in a truck, hit some hospitals on the way. We didn't really know what we were going to be needing. You know, I mean, we knew what we needed. But we didn't know what they needed necessarily. And on the way, that national energy to help these people that were, you know, like the images of New Orleans were pretty dramatic. Everywhere we went, people were buying us dinner. If we stopped, they found out what we were doing. They were like, we got you. No gas, no problem. Go, 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 go. And when we got there, we had a full truck of supplies and we had some good people around us. And, they said, okay, we want you here. And they sent us to Gonzales, just outside of Baton Rouge there. And it was a, deserted Kmart, which we transformed. And I don't want to say just the five of us did this. We did this with 100 other people, but sure, we transformed. Sure. A vacant Kmart into a hospital, and it had everything. Like ICU would really be the only kind of staff that we really didn't have or we weren't taking those types of patients. Those guys were being shipped all over the country, but everybody from the Superdome were coming to us in buses. It was just one bus after another, and you're triaging these people that hadn't been on their medications for over a week. And yeah, it was hot, sticky. I mean, I love Louisiana, don't get me wrong, but there really wasn't a lot of air conditioning in that Kmart, you know, and we didn't have porta potties. I mean, it was the Groovers were these little tents that were pretty gnarly. I remember those specifically, but I have family down there, so I actually was able on occasion to go stay with family and see them and things like that. So for me, it was just kind of a homecoming, you know.
Sure. How long were you there?
Like a week and a half. After the kind of the dust settled, you know, and things kind of started getting, like, so many people who were displaced or in trouble or whatever were moved to a lot of Texas cities, mostly. They're moved all over the country. Once we were no longer really needed, you know, we just shut that whole facility down. It was incredible. Cool. I'd never started a hospital before.
Bravo. It's hard.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It's not easy. So are there any rescues that, like, stick out in your mind as being particularly memorable, either because they were more challenging than they usually should have been, or they played to your particular set of skills, or the weather came out of nowhere and changed the plan, or, you know, because you really felt like you made a difference that, I mean, I know we always make a difference, but you really felt like you made a difference that day. Are there any that just stick out? I know that's a really hard question.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, a lot of people. Yeah, you know, it's not always the saving of a life as much as it is sometimes just the saving of somebody's psyche. You know, people feel like they're going to die in a place, and you're able to get there, establish an evacuation, you know, to a secure place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they were involved in a rock slide and their wife or husband has just died, and they just are completely distraught, you know, and it's like just being there for somebody who has absolutely just experienced the worst thing they've ever had, you know. Those are the ones I think that are the big reason why you do it. People who are unconscious and they're not even present when you're dealing with them, you know, putting them on helicopters, you do follow up and you check on them and they're alive and they have problems and all that, and they say thank you and all that. But it's those people that really saw what was going on, that I think, you know, definitely feels the best for you. Like, you were really making a difference there, you know?
Absolutely. You made somebody's, you know, potentially worst day.
Yeah.
A little bit better. And, you know, and the suffering that was going on, if you're able to ameliorate a little bit of that, it's really special.
Yeah.
And so you are legendary for spending the night out on the Ophir Wall in an unexpectedly difficult rescue. So how was that experience? And that's cold. The Ophir Wall is famous. Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it was cold. I got up to these two guys. One of them had folded his knee back. It wasn't life-threatening, you know, but it was extremely painful, and his knee just went 90 degrees the wrong way. And we didn't have means to get him out because it turned dark and it started snowing. And it snowed all night, and into the next day. And all we could do, and literally we're on a, you know, just like we're sitting on a ledge, you know, with this guy. And I would say every couple of hours, I was really trying to titrate my morphine. I'd give him a little shot of morphine. That's really all I could do. And he just had as much down equipment as we could gather to keep him warm. But we froze. It was a very, very cold night and nobody slept. And, we got blessed with a window of sunlight that came through all these clouds. Helicopter lifted off, came in, I Swami seated him. It was one of those things where you just let your patient go and just keep your fingers crossed that everything was hooked up right. I mean, obviously it was, but sure. You're still, it's just like there's two
you're
to three
exhausted.
Thousand
feet. You've been up all night. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything's cold. Nothing's working right. You know? And, he's still a good friend of mine. Like that, again, like you talk about the people that remember you. This is the kind of person, every time I see him, he just gives you the biggest hug. He's so, to this day, you know, that was a long night for everybody, for sure.
Yeah. And those knee dislocations like that, when they go backwards, they can be life-threatening. It'll take a while, but it can be.
Yeah. Yeah. He probably has some residual stuff, but he hides it well.
Good. That's awesome. That is so cool. Now, so you said you were cold. Like, so has this experience changed kind of what you always have in your pack?
Sure. It is. There are things that I add or take away all the time because of experiences like that, mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. And at night, there was really very little in the way of, tinder that you could use to make any kind of a fire. So if you're not able to do that, you're basically counting on your equipment to keep you alive through, you know, your insulation through the night. But every kind of call, you're like, ah, you know, there's always something to be learned. And, you know, like, I will never do that again, or I'm going to make sure I bring that next time. Mm-hmm. You know, the saying of one is none, two is one, three is two, you know, that's very real when it comes to search and rescue, because the infrequency of the calls, you'll get there and a flashlight will be dead, but your backup might be alive. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
One knife, you know, whatever it is. But yeah, those types of.
Gosh. So cold. So cold. That is, yes, absolutely. My pack is constantly in evolution also. And the biggest thing I think for me is I don't like to be hungry. And so I always have a bunch of like half melted, half reformed protein bars at the bottom of my backpack. And I eat them sometimes. Like sometimes I do get stuck and I need them. And I'm really glad I have them.
2-year-old Almond Joy or something like that. It's the best thing in the world.
It's delicious. And those Twinkies will last forever. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Ophir Wall, it's O-P-H-I-R. And you can look it up. It's a fairly barren, well-known climbing area. So San Diego County is famous for several 14ers.
Yes.
How often do you have to rescue people off Mount Wilson, Wilson Peak, El Diente these days?
I had one 2 weeks ago. A guy and his buddy were backcountry skiing. It's a common ski off of Wilson Peak on the north face. And he had made a couple of turns and then was doing a kick turn and kind of put one foot on a rock or something and stayed there and took a 2,000 foot tumble, you know, through mostly snow, but he went through a couple of cliff bands, definitely bounced off quite a few rocks. And he spent, I think they said 20 days in the ICU afterwards. He was conscious the whole time I was with him. So his helmet was undamaged. So that was lucky that he was very present, you know, very present in the decision making. And I remember going in on this one. A friend of mine, Todd Rector, and I were going in. The winds were super heavy, and we had to drop in the lower alpine and put Todd on the ground and some gear because we couldn't climb. And so I carried on with my ski gear and some rescue equipment, landed, and then Devin went back and picked up Todd. We skied down to this guy where they were and packaged him, basically dug out a LZ for this pretty high pronounced, the skids are a little higher on this C5 than which was in retrospect a good thing because of the angle of the slope. But this guy, he ended up losing a lot of bowel. I know that his internal injuries were were significant and very life-changing. I hope he's doing okay today, but it's nice when they're present and able to be part of the decision. So
absolutely.
Internal injuries, not much you can do other than have that person self-splint. And what I mean by that is if your patient finds a position that he feels like it's comfortable, it doesn't matter what you say, that's the position you leave them in, because he knows better than you, I guarantee it. And in this case, his mesentery artery and things like this, a lot of bleeding were going on. And he felt like this certain position worked for him. It's like, we're going to keep you in that position. And you stay like that. We're not going to move you until I put you in the front seat of the helicopter. So it was one at a time out just because the winds were so severe that day. But yeah, this was just a few weeks ago. And I hope he's doing all right. Yeah.
And you know, a lot of these things, like you adventure in the wilderness, I adventure in the wilderness. I mean, how often do you feel like a lot of these rescues, these injuries that people have, it could happen to anybody. It's just kind of bad luck. They just, like, he's probably a great skier and he just hit a rock that day, or, you know, the rock decided to slide that day. I mean, I'll never forget. I started climbing up Mount Wilson one day and everything didn't look right. I mean, it was a little foggy, but nothing looked right. It turned out there'd been a massive rock slide that it completely changed that whole basin. Yeah. And, yeah. And it was very confusing for me in the fog. And I ended up something is wrong. I need to turn. And fortunately I have a good voice inside my head that tells me to turn around, but it could just happen to anybody out there. Like these avalanches, it could happen to anybody.
Yeah. These guys are some of the best. That's why they're out there, you know? Yeah. Never stop adventuring, you know. I mean, there's nothing bad to say about that, you know. About we all make mistakes, you know. Mm-hmm. Typically, mistakes are made when it comes to a SAR call. It's usually not one mistake, but usually one or two, or God forbid, three or four in a row, and you can't get yourself out. This particular one we just spoke of was one simple mistake.
Yeah, just an accident.
Like, yeah.
Just ski in the wrong spot. So in the middle of all this, you transition to taking on some flight shifts also, like as if you weren't already working enough, right? So how different was it, or the same, to be part of the crew that sort of meets the team? It's kind of like your search and rescue, ski patrol, EMS. I mean, it's flight. So now you kind of have an eye into what everybody's doing, and you understand what everybody's experiencing. So how was flight different, or differently from a search and rescue perspective? Cause you're like, it'll make it easier for the flight crew.
Sure. So I came in with kind of that background, and sort of like the paraglider story that we told earlier, I was kind of the guy who, if it was bad, or if it was, you know, going to be involved with any type of climbing or anything like that, then I was kind of the tap, you know. And with CareFlight, you know, when you're talking about scene calls, you know, it's already bad. They don't call helicopters, you know, for your typical EMS call. It's the worst of the worst, and you know something's seriously wrong. And what was always kind of fun for me, were, like I said, was coming back home for care flight calls, where I knew everybody who was involved in the rescue or on the EMS team or the ski patrol or however it was, and being able to interact with them from a different standpoint, you know, was kind of unique anyway. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Have you ever, like, I know, like, flying in the mountains, there's weather, there are times where, I can't land there, I can't fly there. Have there been times when it's just been really frustrating because communications weren't working or you couldn't be where you needed to be?
Yeah. Well, like you said, weather issues are always a concern. It's like, first and foremost, if the mission's not safe, you know, from a weather standpoint, then we don't even go.
Nope.
And, there's always a saying on a helicopter, it says three to go, one to say no. And if one person says no, the mission's canceled. And I don't care just a gut instinct. You can't put it together why you don't feel right. I've had people say no, and we don't ask why. You just say, okay, you know, I'm not sure whatever you're feeling or seeing, but I think I forgot your question. But
No. I was just talking about the adversity. Like, so sometimes you're communicating, like, on the ground, at least, there were times when we couldn't radio each other because there were mountains in the way, and we wouldn't be able to communicate or get medical direction, the adversity that the terrain, that just the extremity of the terrain, it just creates some difficulty.
Even back then, I got to say, Sarah, things haven't gotten much better.
I mean, it's just technology.
When it comes to communications, it's the thing that always breaks down, you know?
Yes. But, yes. Either it's technology or it's us, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So true to your legendary status, stories do get around. So please tell me more about the crush call.
Crush call. Oh, well, he died, unfortunately. He was one of these guys that I
said, if I knew that.
Yes. So, he was alive. He was dead when I got there. We revived him. I mean, this is very strange because, you know, nothing usually but the hand of God turns around a traumatic injury like this. Mm-hmm. And, this was, he was a gas rigger out on one of these gas rigs and got crushed between two baskets of pipe. And when I say baskets, where they're like a semi truck full of pipe, and you could see the delineation where, you know, where it got him. And, in hindsight, you look back on this and you're like, yeah, there's no way this guy's going to live. But when I got there, we did it, you know, you got all his friends around and, you make an effort, you make an effort, even though you know that, again, trauma's trauma. And, lo and behold, for whatever reason, we were able to bring him back and load him on the helicopter. He's alive. He's intubated, we're pushing meds. And then one thing we don't do on a helicopter is CPR. I mean, if you've ever been in the back of a helicopter, especially an A-Star or a Koala 119, they're tiny.
Yeah, that's different. And, yeah, the Dolphins or the 60s that we fly in, up in Alaska, that's different. Like, you can have a whole crew in there doing CPR, CPR. You could have a whole trauma scene in there. But even the Dolphin, like, you can do it, but not in those little ones.
Oh. No. We landed at the hospital. It was that one of those classic scenes where we slide him off onto the gurney. I get on top of his chest. I'm doing CPR down the elevator to the ER. The trauma surgeon's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I keep bringing him back. You know, he was just alive." And then, sure enough, boom, pulse again. Pulse comes back.
Yeah, they, get the blood.
The doc's like, "Yes, crash." You know, and everybody starts moving. But again, inevitably, he ended up dying.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, I don't know how that came up, but it's just another sad story. There were lots of fortunates.
There's so many of them. I know. It's a hard job. Have you ever felt on any of the scenes like, we need to do things differently right now because our lives are in danger? Like, have you ever looked up and noticed avalanche hang and been like, what are we doing here? Let's get out of here. Or the helicopter. Whatever it was. Have you ever felt like we need to put the brakes on here right now?
Yeah, I would say more in the EMS realm when you're on the side of a highway and there's a lot of cars going by and things like that. Those types of situations are when I'm going to maybe skip some steps that I would normally take just to expedite an evacuation. And that's not for my safety as much as it is for the patient's safety. You know, it's not going to do us any good if we're all dead. So let's get the hell out of here now. And I'll do this other stuff that I want to do in a safer environment. But that happens often. Yeah.
I remember a call. Were you on the call? There was a guy mountain biking in the summer, like flip flops and no helmet, and he wiped out and he was very critical. and we were trying to get him out of there, and light, I mean, like, it was like lightning thunder. And I mean, I don't think I've ever seen everybody move so fast. And I don't remember who was there. I just remember Eric Berg looking at me and saying, "Why is your hair doing that?" And that was mine, where I was like, yeah, one of us could have died that day.
Yeah.
Just because we weren't paying, you know, we weren't paying as much attention to the weather as we should have been, maybe.
Yep, for sure.
So are you still doing flight, or did you stop that?
Oh, no, 2011, 2010.
That's right.
Basically, we had, the first year I started, we had a crash. Care Flight 3 went down and killed three of my friends. And at the wedding, my then fiance turned to me and was, or not at the wedding, sorry, at the funeral of one of these guys. Like, Scott was the paramedic, who's a buddy of mine. He had two babies, like, in diapers when he died, and orphaned these two little kids. And Podmeyer was the nurse. He was a great guy. Bill was the pilot. It was a settling with power issue, you know, up near Mancos. And at any rate, at the funeral or at the wake, I made a promise to Pam that when our firstborn came, that I would quit, you know. And it really wasn't until Xander, my secondborn, was probably almost a year old that I actually quit. You know, I kept saying, yes, I'm going to stop. And but finally did. And that was when I started running for coroner.
Okay. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, because several rescue helicopters have gone down, and medevac planes have gone down. It feels like, I mean, and I don't know if the news is just getting to me more or what's happening, but it's
every time in a helicopter, just that couple weeks ago with the ski accident, you're always asking yourself or wondering, is this the one, you know, every time. You know, and some people get lucky and most do not in a helicopter anyway.
No, I used to be terrified of helicopters, and then the Coast Guard kind of ameliorated some of that for me, and I'm okay riding in their helicopters, but I respect the helicopter. I respect gravity. So how did you end up becoming deputy coroner? Like,
when Telluride went to full-time paramedics, we found ourselves pretty much always on every fatality. And I guess the coroner at the time, Bob Dempsey, recognized that. He came to us and was like, hey, this doesn't involve any extra training or outside stuff, but what I'd like you to do is look over this package, you know, and it's just a checklist of some things that information that has to be gathered. And a lot of times we'll scoop somebody up and then they die again in a helicopter, or they die at the med center, or, you know, in the hospital or something like that. But what he recognized was we were the tip of the spear. We were on all these events almost all the time. Mm-hmm. And why not try and take advantage of that, gathering information, making sure witnesses, you get statements, things like that. So it wasn't highly investigative, but it was a convenient thing for him, and a little extra money in our pockets every time we were on a fatality. That's how it started. So it's for 10 years. Yeah, for 10 years, I just sort of did that. Not really doing the whole job as it is these days, you know, as coroner.
All right. And then, to bring up another tough one. But years ago, I remember hearing about a cult related homicide. Did you have to respond to that?
Yeah, I spent 2 days out at this, let's just call it a ranch. I don't know, this property. And this group who did not have any affiliation with any other type of group. They were all from, we're a hodgepodge, but the majority of them were from Haiti and Jamaica. And they had gathered quite a few other people as they crossed the country, basically, in search of whatever they were searching for. You know, basically, it was an end of days type cult. They they anticipated this ecliptical event to be the end of days. The earth would open up and everybody who wasn't with them would die, and they would transcend in the light body, quote unquote, and be forever whatever. That was what, and I like to call her the Mambo Priestess, just because she was like the leader of this group and the closest thing that I've ever seen to something that resembled voodoo. What they ended up doing was putting two little girls to death. They banished them into a vehicle without water or food in the end of May. And in Norwood, it's pretty hot in the end of May. And we kind of determined that they maybe made it 18 hours, 24 hours before they succumbed to, you know, probably dehydration, you know. But they sealed this vehicle, they wrapped it up, duct taped the whole thing, sealed it in a tarp, made a very strange burial out of it. Long story short is, somebody close to one of the other cult members caught wind that their son wasn't doing well, was involved in this cult, had lost a lot of weight, his dog was dying, all this kind of weird stuff. So he made access on the property. When he saw what was going on, he called 911, and that's when the troops came in. And we walked onto this property. Everybody's jaw was on the ground. There were the symbology drawn on the ground, carved in trees, on stumps, written everywhere, pieces of paper, crystals, machetes, dolls. It was a mixture of like ancient Egyptian, like Roman mysticism and Hinduism. There was obviously a very strong voodoo element to it, and Santeria was pretty prominent. We sent all this stuff to Wade County in Florida there, because they deal with a lot of religious stuff, probably more so than almost anywhere. And they were, you have nothing that is a recognized religion that we've ever seen. What you have here is a salad of all these different things. And anyway, long story short, after 2 years, the people who had basically commanded this and carried this act out were all given roughly 25 years each. And it was a strange group. They were shrouded in either all white, all brown, all purple. They stood out big time in Norwood. It was like, what is going on up there?
And like ranching community.
Yeah. Yeah. It was surprising that it went on as long as it did without somebody sticking their nose in a little sooner. You know, we thought we were digging up. We thought they were burials. We were digging up things. We thought we were going to find bodies everywhere. And every time we dug something up, it would be like a chest full of, like voodoo stuff, like knives and dolls and tinctures and crystals. They loved their crystals. They had huge crystals. And then we dig up another one and another one. And it was just, I don't know what they were doing. They were getting rid of their earthly possessions, getting ready to go on this event, you know. And anyway.
Oh, that's so sad. I'm so sorry.
It was a crazy learning experience for me, you know.
That is crazy. Were these kids from their compound, or had they kidnapped the kids?
No, they were family members. One of the mothers, she was so deep into this that she allowed it. And this is what she was told to do and be a part of. And she had another child actually in prison. Pretty sad. They picked her up walking down a highway, and you're just like, how do you just walk away from something like that? It was crazy.
Okay. So then you decided to run for lead coroner.
Yeah.
How did this come about?
2010, I stopped flying, and I was being encouraged to take over from the guy who'd done it for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the money and I kind of looked at the job and it would keep me in town. And I already found it very fascinating. I mean, being a coroner is kind of the closest thing you're going to get to sort of being Sherlock Holmes in San Miguel County, you know, and it is actually very interesting. You know, you dig in on somebody's life after they die and you learn so much about them. I learned more about not everything, but I know all their dirty little secrets more than their, sure, their wives and their husbands and children and things like that. Like, it's pretty crazy the things you find, but it's never gets old. You know, you're just, there's always something you're just like, wow, I didn't see that coming. Anyway, ran for that. Tough race, but I pulled it out and then went off to, got certified as a death investigator and got nationally certified as a death investigator and hired a few other deputies to also go. So I changed the office completely. It was very simplistic at the time, and I feel like we are as good or better than most in Colorado as far as you know, how we fulfill our statutory duties there.
Good, right on. And so how much more responsibility was it for you? Like, I guess the time
from a coroner, really... as from a deputy to a coroner. Oh well, mm-hmm. The paperwork is the big thing. But I didn't know what I didn't know. Like I said, when I became coroner, I was not an investigator. I thought I knew a little bit about this, that, or the other, and I did. But when you go off to school, you spend, you know, a few weeks or a couple weeks in St. Louis University, and you learn a lot more about deaths and it just opens your eyes to what you're walking in on. You know, you never trust anybody or what they're telling you, things like that. It's a weird position to be in, but it, like I said, it's fascinating and it never gets old. I've had the weirdest calls.
You're an extreme coroner. It's like, it's a very remote part of the U.S. that's, you know, not well traveled and unusual things happen there and the terrain is crazy. And
I will say I'm one of the only coroners in Colorado that ends up on a lot of their like backcountry death calls. I'm on the ground when, you know, and they're like, oh, the coroner's already here. You know, that's not typically how it goes in most counties, but it's kind of interesting. I'll be on calls like we were talking about earlier for different counties. And I'm just like, hey, I got this one wrapped up. I can take care of it for you if you want. It's not even my county. And they're, yeah, go for it. You know what's going on. It's already yours.
Because it's a national certification. Oh, that's great. Yep. That's great. So I'm going to switch gears here a little bit because I just had a thought. So in your mind, what are some of the things that, like, if you were giving advice to younger medics, what are some of the things that they, like, tricks that they could do to stabilize injuries that occur in these remote environments as they work on, you know, transport or getting help?
Yeah. You know, early on, you're so entrenched in your book knowledge, you know, and I don't want to belittle all the book knowledge, but I will tell you that there is a different dimension that opens up with time. You know, when you get on calls and you recognize after a few years, you should start to develop this. You recognize, all right, this is serious. You know, you see it without having to even break out any equipment. You can just see it, like, because you've seen it before, mm-hmm, over and over again. So, you know, again, not to belittle the book knowledge, but nothing will supplement real life experience. And you know, getting out of school, throw yourselves to the wolves, you know, get in there, but trial by fire, really try and put yourself in some nasty places where you will be pushed, you will be tested, mm-hmm, you know? And when you come out the other side, you will be stronger for it. And to the point now where your heart rate doesn't go up when a page goes off anymore because you've seen it all. And, you know, your job, you didn't cause this problem. You're just trying to organize chaos. And, you'll know when you're good at it. And, test yourself. Just, don't take an easy way out, you know?
Yeah. Yep. I love it. Confidence is such a beautiful thing. Confidence backed up by competence is the most beautiful thing. So is there any piece of medical gear that is like always in your kit or backpack? Like I'm I always have a little bit of duct tape and a couple safety pins. Even if it's like a fancy purse or a clutch, it probably has duct tape. It might have a tourniquet.
Yeah. Tourniquet's a good thing to have. I have seen makeshift tourniquets not work. You know, I used to be people would be like, I've got three things on my body right now that I can make a tourniquet out of. And maybe you could, but I've seen some bad bleeds that people have done makeshift tourniquets with.
Yeah, it's the user.
And it is like a commercial grade combat tourniquet. Sometimes I even felt like I've put them on many times now, and you have to put them on sometimes so tight you feel like you're going to break it, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's nothing on your body that supplements that. I would say, if you can, I think a tourniquet's great. I always keep an epi. I always keep diphenhydramine gel caps, on you. Again, you can kind of make a Band-Aid out of, like you said, if you got duct tape and anything, you can kind of do stuff like the little things. But Peter Hackett always used to say, just take what you think you're going to need. And that was the worst answer to a question like you just asked me that you could ever get. But I always loved his nonchalance and how he was just like, what are you going to say? Every call is different, you know? And like I said earlier, items come and go. You know, because of something you've seen two or three times in a row doesn't mean you're going to see it the rest of your life, you know, and you'll be carrying that shit around the rest of your life thinking it's going to happen again. So my kit is like in my little backpack when I go on hikes is pretty small, you know. My ski backpack kit is a little bit bigger. And then the one I use for when I'm working and things like that, it's a backpack, you know, it's a much bigger kit, you know, and I can do sutures and, you know, I would say super glue always. I've used super glue so many times in the backcountry. I always like to give a pain med if you can get your hands on some Vicodin or, you know, Percocets or fentanyl patches work really well. Or obviously you have access to schedule two, you know, you can always, you know, I am something. So, at any rate,
I think it's easier for a paramedic to walk around with those things than it is for a physician, like from law wise.
I've been pretty lucky. They're probably getting more and more scrutinized every year, you know, but, I wear so many hats and I have so many different forms of identification that if anybody ever asks, they're always like, get out of here. You know,
get out of here. Good. Yeah. Oh my God. So Emil, you have had just an incredibly diverse career. You've managed to marry your love of the outdoors and adventure with a successful medical career. And, I have to ask if right now of all the things of all the hats you're wearing right now is would you still say Ski Patrol is your favorite or?
It's the one that keeps me the healthiest mentally and physically. I would say EMS is the one that probably had if you've ever followed it the largest burnout. You know, because you're just running calls all the time and sometimes you feel like you're being abused and all of that, you know.
You get the frequent flyers and
it's not as healthy mentally or physically as say search and rescue or definitely not Ski Patrol. But Ski Patrol stands alone. I mean, I love blowing things up and skiing powder never gets old. when you're around people that like to do those same things, you usually get along with them pretty well, and we have a good time together. So I don't know if that answers it or not.
Yeah, it did. Absolutely. Absolutely. I figured I'd circle us back to that. And then, so being in charge, you know, you've taken over in charge of Telluride Fire Protection District. And what changes, like right when you came in, what changes did you make? Like from a vision perspective, you're like, right. Oh, we need to do this. This has to be more efficient. What were some of the two of the biggest changes you felt like you made when you took over?
Biggest changes?
Or more again, kinda, impactful. They don't have to be like major. Just
most right. I felt like kind of getting the team all on the same page was the most important thing, meaning like creating a stronger sense of team. I took over as chief paramedic from Jill in 2004. And trying to always lead by example and always be as professional as you possibly can so that everybody around you wants to be as professional as they can. You know, like it has to start from the top, but that sense of pride is super important. That enchantment in something you love has to be there. Otherwise, again, it's an empty motion. And why are you doing this? You know? And so my main thing was just to really always try and when we're, you know, after calls and things like that, just having a good time with the group, always having a good time and just, keep people learning, keep it fresh. And, you know, if you see somebody who's burning out, you got to have that talk with them. It's like, you can't be like this here. You know, for clarity,
it is kind of like a poison. It's kind of like a poison.
Yeah, exactly. But for clarity, I was chief paramedic from 2004 till I guess it would be 2021, and then we ran this huge COVID testing experiment, I'll call it, in Telluride. I had met some people who had a biotech. Yeah, I've met some people who had a biotech company, and mostly over in China and Taiwan. And they, you know, I talked to them about the antigen tests that were going around at the time. And they were like, oh, we've been doing that for years. We could do, I was like, well, let's do Telluride. He goes, hell, why would we do Telluride? We could do the whole county in a week. And, you know, my eyes just got really big. And so I tried to grow this thing. And I had been asked by the upper brass to either step into a full-time administrative position or just stay in the field. And I put that off and I kept putting that off and I kept putting it off because I felt like I was doing both pretty well. But when we did the COVID testing and we had to set up for, you know, doing 8,000-10,000 tests. What we didn't realize, and we were doing it. It was amazing how organized it was and how the county and the towns and everybody got on board. And COVID was scary, you know, like Katrina was one of those things where the entire country was like, okay, we're all doing this, you know? Mm-hmm. And, but that particular event, kind of got a little out of hand. I mean, we were being, scrutinized by all the news channels, Rachel Maddow and all these other guys were all interviewing us. Yeah. And,
I don't watch the news.
they all wanted to, like this little town in Colorado is doing all their own testing. So we got a lot of accolades from that. Unfortunately, when I was trying to put all these, samples on ice and then send them to labs that could test for us, that's when the inundation on every lab in the country really hit. And I could not beg hard enough. I had samples going to Tennessee, Oakland, Maryland, all over the place, whoever would take them. And I'm begging these people to work, you know, overtime to give us our results. Because if you don't get results, there's no reason to have a second round of testing so that you know where your county sits, you know, with its level of infection. And so did we get a sample size that was accurate? It was already very low because it was San Miguel. We only had a few that were positive, but that being said, the amount of time and the testing that it took, the level of accuracy dropped off the table and it just really didn't work. A lot of other communities were calling us, trying to find out, like using us as a template for them and what we need to do. And I was like, make sure you got Spanish speaking. I mean, it was really cool and an honor to do, but it was a crazy time. That's for sure.
That was it. That sounds like a really tough assignment, and just the logistics of all of it. I mean, just the logistics of taking care of, you know, large amounts of unexpected people. And I can only
18 hour days for 2 weeks. It was crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have any advice for eager young medics who might be watching thinking, I want to be that. I want to do speed control and SAR, and I want to do all those things. Like, I know it's really hard to say, like, this is, I don't know how I ended up in my career. It was just a series of happy accidents and hard work, obviously. But any advice for a young medic who is at the beginning of their career?
I kind of do and I kind of don't. I mean, I think anybody and everybody need to, again, I never had a design. You know, there was never a design like, this is how I want things. And I think a lot of the younger people these days have a design. Everything that happened to me sort of happened organically, and it was because I left myself open to make changes and decisions, you know, and I didn't shut doors because that wasn't part of the design. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't fit my plan, so I'm not doing it. I would be like, maybe, I'll try it. Okay, we'll try it, you know. So, you know, if you're somebody who needs a hardcore plan, I'm probably not your guy, because I never had one. You know, it just sort of developed the way it developed. And, I don't have any regrets. I just don't know how you would, I don't know how I would duplicate it, to be honest. You know, opportunities come up and you jump on them, you know, recognizing opportunities, you know.
Mm-hmm. And going to the place, going to the difficult place. If you want to be a search and rescue medic, then go live someplace where they have a lot of search and rescue.
Yeah.
And if you find want to be,
find a small town that needs help, you know, and get educated.
The difference and be the help.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. So what do you envision for your future? It's okay if the answer is more of the same.
I got to get my kids in college. Two are already out and two are probably going to be in college in the next few years. I don't know. Pam and I talk about a lot of crazy stuff. But I don't know. I might go on Dancing with the Stars or something like that. I have no idea. I don't know what I'm going to do. I could see early retirement and just do more traveling, you know, just hang out with Pam more and travel. And I just got back from a really cool, family stuff, you know, that's the most important. I just spent a week and a half up in Nova Scotia riding around on motorcycles with my dad and had his 83rd birthday as well as Father's Day out on the road, you know, camping out and stuff like that. Yeah, it's cool. It's really cool. So
good for him.
He never thought he'd have another motorcycle again. He got rid of his old GS Beamer, you know, and I was like, we're going to go smaller. We're going to get smaller bikes and keep doing this, you know, and he's anyway, that's what to do, I have no idea, but I don't think I'm going to be doing any of this in like 5 years. I'd be surprised.
Wow. All right. Young medics, move out to Telluride and start being an understudy. There you go. So any final thoughts you want to leave with listeners?
Boy, I mean, unless you bait me with something, I can't really think of anything, but,
I think you said it earlier. I think you said, don't be afraid, do adventure. Like we see a lot of like the worst case scenarios, but we still are out adventuring.
Yeah.
I think you actually said it earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. If emergency medicine is something you're going to get into, I'm pretty sure it's going to feed you well. I don't know a lot of people that have gotten into it that regret it, you know? So it's never routine and it's always different. And it always comes with that adrenaline. So Just keep it fresh, you know. Keep doing what you love. I don't know. I'm not,
Yeah.
no philosopher, that's for sure.
But I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. I think it's just, and it gets you into this autotelic state, because so many of our assignments and our jobs, you know, require all of your thought and all of your skills. And so I feel like that it's very satisfying when you're working in a state that's requiring all of your skills, because you don't have any time to think about anything else, or to have that negative self-talk.
Yeah.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for giving us your time and your knowledge and your experience. And this has just been so much fun. And so I want to say thank you to Lieutenant Paramedic Emil Sante for spending time with me today. This has been incredibly inspiring and educational, and I love it that we can demonstrate to people that they can have an evolving portfolio career and enjoy every stage of it. And I respect how you have stepped up to meet the needs of the community and how generous you are with your strengths and your gifts with this small community. And I know that everyone there appreciates it too. I know they do.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
And to everyone, please join us at the World Extreme Medicine Expo in Edinburgh, Scotland in November, where Dr. Joseph Dettori, aka Dr. Deepsea, and I will be presenting our findings on the physical, physiological, and psychological tests performed on him during Project Neptune 100. And if you haven't already heard, that was where he spent 100 days living in an undersea habitat. I will also be teaching improvised field gear, which is always a fun course, and I learn as much as I teach. And everyone, consider putting a team together for the MedWar race, which is new this year, where you can test your extreme medicine knowledge, skills, and speed. Thank you again to everyone listening. And if you are listening with us, you too are an extreme medic, and we welcome you to the World Extreme Medicine family. Stay safe out there, but also keep pushing your boundaries.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.